Hi, and welcome to another episode of the IQ and Human Intelligence Podcast from Riot IQ. I'm Dr. Russell T. Warren, and today my guest is Eugene Lin, who is a researcher and doctoral student at King's College London. We're here to talk about her new article in the journal Intelligence and Cognitive Abilities. The article's title is Polygenic Score Prediction Within and Between Sibling Pairs for Intelligence, Cognitive Abilities, and Educational Traits from Childhood to Early Adulthood. This is an open access article that anyone can read for free. And I'm excited to talk to Yujing, the first author, about it. So welcome to the podcast, Yujing.
Hello, thank you for inviting me.
I'm happy to have you. Well, first, tell me a little bit about your background and how you got interested in behavioral genetics.
Yes, so I actually did my undergraduate study at the States. And when I was doing my undergrad, I had a dual degree in journalism and psychology. I think it wasn't uncommon to see like a journalism student also do like psychology, but I think I was like the only one that like continued in the psychology field. And then here I am in the field of behavioral genetics.
Mm-hmm. And how did you get interested in behavioral genetics if you started off in journalism?
Okay, so when I was doing journalism, I think there is a lot of conversation about the mental health crisis and a lot about like mental health disorders. And then that got me interested in the pathology side of mental health, which got me into an animal lab, actually studying the epigenetic mechanism of how prenatal maternal stress is going to affect the susceptibility of the offspring in autism using mice. And then that kind of like got me interested in genetics. And then as I dive deeper, I find that a lot of the genetic studies review that, because we know for phenotypes, a lot of the phenotypes are actually correlated with each other. And there is this phenomenon called comorbidity. For example, if you have one mental health disorder, you may also have like a higher chance to have like another one. And we may think of it as because we are in this not as good environment, but research shows that it's actually because the underlying genetic mechanism are similar for some of these like phenotypic traits. That's why we've observed this like phenotypic correlations. So then I get more involved in behavioral genetics. And I would say like the most fascinating things is the study design, the adoption study, as well as the twin study in behavioral genetics.
Well, that makes a lot of sense that you're interested in the investigation part. That's where you started off in journalism. And science really is very much about trying to figure out what Mother Nature or what environment has done to cause us to see X. And then you end up in a autism lab, which is a highly genetically influenced condition.
Yes.
And so I see the natural progression. I didn't think it started off at journalism, but I see the progression. Now, this article is not about mental health, but I do see some similarities because you're right. There are shared genetic influences between different mental health conditions. Well, we also see shared genetic influences across different cognitive abilities.
Yeah, exactly. It's like it's kind of like a parallel topic. If you think of it, we have this general cognitive ability, the G factors, and then in mental health, we also have the general psychopathology factor, it's the P factor. And yeah.
Yes, and just like within the G factor, we have certain lower order factors where certain variables clump together. I believe in and now you can correct me, in psychopathology, it's where the internalizing disorders, they tend to clump together. So depression and anxiety disorders, and then the externalizing orders tend to clump together. And those would be things like schizophrenia, I want to say, is externalizing, bipolar disorder. So there are some similarities, and I really feel like, yeah, we can learn about the genetics of mental health through the genetics of cognitive ability and vice versa. So I'm glad you're working on both.
Yeah, definitely. And it actually like first in the cognitive abilities, and then we kind of like apply a similar framework in mental health. But it's just like I kind of like started in the field working with mental health first, but now I am like working on the cognitive abilities.
That's awesome. Well, let's turn to this specific article in Intelligence and Cognitive Abilities. Can you summarize the article for me?
Yes. So we use polygenic score. You may also see it as a polygenic risk score or a polygenic index, but we'll just use polygenic score. And is a genetic predictors to assess individual differences in a phenotype of interest. For example, if we have a polygenic score for cognitive ability, then is a genetic predictors for like how we differ in our phenotypic cognitive outcomes. And so far, study using polygenic score is actually not very novel in the field. It has been like used for the past decades, and the highest prediction using polygenic score is for cognitive abilities as well as educational outcomes. Like I mentioned, this is not like novel in the field, but what we are interested in is that recently some researchers kind of questions this very high prediction or this very high variance explain about it. So the predictive power doesn't just come from something we call the population predictions. It has two components. It's like this within family components and the between family components, and as how we define it. And why is this important? Because yeah, someone is questioning the predictive power of one of the most predictive polygenic score in the field. And we think it's like, as a scientist, we think it's like our responsibility to dive deeper into it. And we think like everything it captures do have like a valid point, or like do have like are valid components of the genetic prediction.
So if I understand you correctly, first we get these polygenic scores. And so that our audience understands, these are numbers, they're scores we get from analyzing people's DNA based on earlier studies. We use their DNA variants and we're able to predict. In this case, it might be intelligence, but really we could do a polygenic score about any genetically influenced trait. We can have a polygenic score for depression, for diabetes. Yeah. We can have a polygenic score for, in your article, one of the ones you use is height.
Yes.
And you're right. This article is not a breakthrough saying, look, we can predict IQ from DNA. I was a professor as recently as 3.5 years ago, and I would tell my students in my human intelligence class, and this is 3.5 years ago, we can take a DNA swab of a newborn baby today and predict that child's adult IQ, and that prediction will be about as good back then as predicting the child's IQ with the adults, with their parents' SES, their socioeconomic status. So yes, you're right that this isn't new, but I do like how you piece out the predictions. You say, okay, here's the predictive power overall. Here's how much comes within the family, and here's how much comes from the population level, from variables that
are outside background.
Outside the family or the whole family background. So no, that's good. And I really like it. So why is it important to compare the within family genetic predictions with the between family genetic predictions, which is what you're doing here?
Yes. So we can start talking briefly about what is a within family prediction. So we start with these population predictions because the ultimate goal of a polygenic score is to predict like unrelated individuals. So just like you or I, a random people on the street, to predict their certain outcomes. And then, I initially think of like, this is like the definition of population prediction is predicting the using polygenic score or like other genetic predictors to predict their outcomes among unrelated people. And I actually think of like within family predictions. So is that going to be different? For example, if you have a sibling, and is the polygenic score prediction for you is going to be different from, I mean, let me phrase it differently. So if you have a sibling, will the population predictions also apply to you and your sibling? That being said, that is the within family prediction. So I initially understand the population predictions pretty much the same concept as within family prediction. So it can predict unrelated population, and so it can also predict related population just the same. But it ends up that because a lot of the things that are sharing within the household that's also picked up by this polygenic score. For example, we have this phenomenon called assortative mating, which is partner tend to choose the part, like person tend to choose their partner based on, we can say like phenotypic correlation, but ultimately is genetic correlations. And we do observe like quite a high genetic correlations for traits like cognitive abilities and educational outcomes. So that is also, so like two person with like very high educations, they mate with each other and then they give birth to this child, or like they give birth to a couple of children. And their similarities on one hand coming from, of course, the Mendelian like inheritance of random genes that they get from their parents. But the other side is that this overall like familial background that's provided to the children and everyone share the same. So within family kind of captures the sibling differences using a within sibship design. So we look at how siblings differ in their polygenic score and use that to predict their difference in their phenotypes. Whereas the population predictions is just the overall, like an unrelated individual, how their polygenic score predict their phenotypes. And then we define between family effects as how the population prediction exceeds the within family predictions.
Okay. And now you mentioned assortative mating, where people tend to find mates who are similar to them on certain traits. We do see this pretty strongly on educational attainment. It's funny you mentioned that, because my wife and I discovered after we were married that we are actually ninth cousins. So I don't know how much assortative mating that causes. Ninth cousins, you know, we have a very, very distant common ancestor, but there's some pedigree collapse
legal,
there.
So.
Yeah, it's legal. Ninth cousins, we're not embarrassed by it. Yeah. It's actually a little funny, but there's some assortative mating, and that can drive up the predictors. Correct me if I have this right. It drives up the population predictor, but it drives down the within family predictor because it's making the siblings more alike. Or do I have that backwards?
It doesn't really influence the within family predictors.
Oh, okay.
Because it's just like we have, it drives up the familial background, which is the between family predictions, whereas within family is I kind of understand it as a random process or like a Mendelian lottery, because it basically comes from like how embryo form through meiosis, which we think is a quite like a random process, whereas the between family effects is more like a systematic genetic phenomenon.
Got it. Okay. Well, thanks for correcting me there. So assortative mating drives up these population unrelated individuals' predictions. But I'm looking at figure two in your article, and for almost every outcome you look at, the cognitive abilities, the different IQ predictors, educational achievement, educational attainment, BMI height, for almost all of these, the within family predictions are weaker than the population predictions. And you said assortative mating is one reason for this. what else can cause this within family prediction to be weaker? Because it's obviously not something unique to IQ.
Mm-hmm. Oh, definitely not unique to IQ. Another source of between family genetic prediction is population stratification or population structure, is when people tend to gather in certain regions and they may have like the similar genetic background as well as like a similar likelihood of having a trait. So the population stratification is when people gather in an area that also have like a higher correlation for their phenotypes. So when we are doing genetic predictions, then that is going to pick up, even though it's like a population thing, it could come from the environment and it could also come from genetics. And then another source is passive gene-environment correlation. And this is a phenomenon when the parents will provide an environment that's genetically matched the children's genetic propensities, that's also match like the parents' genetic propensity, apparently.
Which makes sense. You know, I look at my family where we have children and my wife and I have similar interests. Those are probably genetically influenced. And then we create a home where we can enjoy those interests and some of those genes get passed on to our children.
Definitely.
And so that's what you're talking about.
Yes, exactly. And I always think of the environment because what is environment? I mean, it's definitely like an outside of like genetic aspect of it, but is also influenced by the genetics. So I sometimes think of environment as like an extended phenotype of us. So it's not like we may think of it as like purely random, but it's not like purely random as we think about it.
Mm-hmm. No, you're right. Yes, environment shapes us, especially on the long-term evolutionary scale of thousands or millions of years.
Yeah, definitely.
But individually, we also either select or shape mm-hmm. our own environments.
Yes.
And, you know, we can do that in a wide variety of ways. And so thinking about genetically influenced environments, I think, is a sensible modern way to think about this. Instead of just saying, well, here's environment, here's genetics, they're separate, they're different, never the twain shall meet. No,
never.
So please describe for me the role that socioeconomic status has in the relationship between the polygenic scores and the cognitive and educational outcomes that you found in your article.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we're not definitely not like the first person to include socioeconomic status or SES in our study. And we kind of included it because we want to find a measurable proxy for between family effects, because we know that this gap between population and within family prediction is between family effects. This is how we define it. But what is it? So here comes socioeconomic status. So we basically add it as an additional predictor, and the between family prediction then was taken away by the socioeconomic status, which we can kind of say like these two things are like kind of equivalent to each other. And that's why after we put in the socioeconomic status into our model, then our population predictions, so the overall predictions of like using genetic predictors towards, for example, cognitive ability decreased, but it barely influenced the within family prediction.
Okay. And we don't know whether socioeconomic status is causal or not, but we do know that whatever relationship it has with these polygenic scores, it's functioning at the between family level. It's not functioning in a way that makes the scores more predictive of one sibling compared to another. Am I understanding you correctly?
Yeah.
Let's talk about the difference between family effects and population-wide effects. We hinted at this a little bit, like socioeconomic status being a between family effect, but population stratification functioning at the population level. I see the two as being very similar, but you and your co-authors make a distinction. So please explain that to me.
Yes, so the reason why we want to define it as population versus within family is that first, we think it's less confusing because all of us know what is a population predictions, and you just need to get your head around within family predictions. And a lot of the papers kind of describe this difference or shrinkage, attenuations, this gap as this gap, basically. So mm-hmm. there is not a name to this with these between family effects that we define.
As things like socioeconomic status and things that really are functioning at the family level and not at the whole population level?
Yeah, so like we kind of use, because a lot of the, not like a lot, I feel like I'm attacking people. No, I'm not attacking people. So this phenomenon saying the gap between population predictions and within family prediction as a bias, but we think because they are valid source of predictions, this assortive mating, population stratification, and passive gene-environment correlation effects, these are very true and it exists in all of us. So mm-hmm. we want to give a name to it. So that's why we define the difference between population and within family prediction as the between family predictions.
And that makes sense to me because you mentioned the exception of embryo selection, where we have a series of embryos formed because of in vitro fertilization. And genetically, those embryos are siblings. So that's a case where these weaker within family predictions matter. But except for that, we're mostly interested in seeing whether this person over here and that unrelated person over there are going to have a better chance of success or a higher risk for a mental health condition or an addiction. And so instead of looking at the glasses half empty, oh, these within
yeah,
family
exactly.
predictions are weaker, they're not as useful, you say, well, no, the population-wide predictions capitalize on, yes, the within-family differences among siblings, but they also capitalize on the between-family differences and the population characteristics. Why not capitalize on these other things, make our predictions better, even though not all of that predictive power comes from genes causing the outcome?
Yeah, exactly. It's a very good point because mm-hmm. we always think of polygenic score as a genetic predictor for individual differences, that it must capture causal genes. But we know a lot of these findings are associations, and the only way for us to get to causality is to do animal study, basically, because we can't just knock a gene out in a baby and then like keep them in a restricted environment and then to see how that gene is going to affect their outcome. So it's I think it's also like a, I think it's like common in the field that we are aware that a lot of these are associations or like valid predictors, but it's not causal. And it could operate through like genetic pathway, and it can also operate through the environmental pathway. And yeah, and we can kind of think about it as like operating through genetics or environment. But if we really thinking about it, like genetics doesn't operate in a vacuum. So we have to be in an environment for them to function. Otherwise, it's just a set
so,
of...
So yeah. Why not capitalize on the environment? No, it makes sense. And for a while, I worked for a social media company in their advertising area. And they would scoop up huge amounts of data about each user to figure out which ads would be interesting to you, which videos you'll want to see. They didn't care if it was causal. They didn't care if you wanted to see this ad because there was a causal relationship between
Yeah,
their variable
exactly.
and the ad you'd want to see. They didn't care. They just said, all we know is that people with these characteristics are interested in this ad. It's a
Yes.
predictor. Who cares where it's causal? And that's where I see you do what you're doing here with these population predictors. Okay, who cares if some of this is a direct genetic effect and some of it is assorted of mating and socioeconomic status and some of it's population
Like
stratification?
indirect as
Yeah,
you could
indirect.
frame it.
Yeah, who cares if not all of this is causal? We can still make the prediction.
Yeah, exactly.
We could still figure out who's more likely to succeed at college, who's at higher risk of diabetes, who's at higher risk of stroke. Why not capitalize
Yeah.
on everything the social media companies do?
Yeah, and it's quite a convenient score if you think of polygenic score because you can just calculate it for everyone by getting their saliva, and you don't need to ask them like how much your parents made each year and what's the highest degree of your parents and then like which area do you live to in order to like get all of this information from them.
No,
I mean,
you're
yeah.
right. Because self-report, we know it's not always trustworthy. Now, the hard thing is getting the saliva. A social media company can't get that very easily.
Yeah.
But, if you have the data, then it's probably far easier to get that if you already have the DNA sample than to try to give people a big long survey with enough variables cobbled together to create an equally good predictor. Okay, interesting. I also found interesting that the polygenic scores had the same predictive power for people at the top and the bottom of the IQ distribution. Why is that analysis worthwhile, and what's that tell us about the genes for high IQ and low IQ?
Yeah, if we think about, for example, a very, very smart person, we may think that there must be something unique to their genetics, which when I turns to like scientific words, then it will be so for example, two person, one is much smarter and the other is not as smart, and they may have like 10 score, I mean not 10 because polygenic score doesn't work like a 10 score difference, but if we think they are like one standard deviation apart from each other, but one person is much smarter than the other, whereas we are trying to look at is that everyone is like, for example, people being one standard deviation apart from each other for their polygenic score, how is the difference for their cognitive outcomes going to be different? And this linearity or this analysis that we do is basically trying to look at in the population. So we're not looking at like really extreme cases of people having like de novo mutations, for example, like Down syndrome. I'm not saying like Down syndrome is due to de novo mutations, but for example, individuals with Down syndromes, then there would be something that's quite unique about their genetic composition. But like a population-wide speaking, how does our individual differences in polygenic score going to predict our individual differences in our outcomes? And the reason why a like at the high end and low end of the normal distribution. So we know these normal distributions, and then we know that a lot of us are like in the middle, which is like the majority, and the high end and low end are like the much fewer people are going to like be over there. And we find that the genetic composition of cognitive abilities or educational outcomes is mainly due to these additive genetic effects. That means if at the high or low end, the people may also be one standard deviation apart from each other, but they won't be like super different from each other in their phenotypes as compared to like the people in the middle of the normal distribution, which is like the majority of the population.
Got it. So if I understand you correctly, we're excluding people with Down syndrome, people with genetic mutations that cause an intellectual disability. So within the typically developing population.
Yes.
Basically, what you're saying is the same genetic variants that result in someone being more intelligent or less intelligent, they're operating across the whole continuum of typical development. There's not a special group of genes making geniuses smarter than the rest of us. The same genes that the same genes that make someone with an IQ of 115 smarter than someone with an IQ of 100 are also going to be part of the reason why someone with an IQ of 130 is smarter than that person with 115 or 85 and 100. Am I understanding
correctly? Exactly. So that's how we call it, like an additive or like a quantitative genetic effects instead of like a non-additive or like a multiplicative genetic effects.
Got it. Okay. I was also interested in your article's discussion towards the end on pages 9 to 10 of the missing heritability between the polygenic score's predictive power and what we see in twin studies. Now, for our audience members who aren't familiar with missing heritability, the idea is that based on the twin studies, we have a certain amount of expected genetic influence on a phenotype, such as IQ. But then when we actually calculate the polygenic scores from people's DNA, we're not getting that level of predictive power or genetic influence. And we call that gap missing heritability. Your study finds the lower heritability from the polygenic scores and from the twin heritability. That's typical. But you think that the missing heritability gap may be larger than what we've thought in the past. Why is that?
Yeah, we think it's actually one of the novel finding, unique, or like not as unique, like one of the novel finding for our study, because let me kind of reiterate the concept of twin heritability. So we can compare monozygote twin and dizygote twins, and then the twin heritability actually mainly coming from comparing twins, which is siblings. So because we're comparing siblings, then this is actually a within family effect. So the twin heritability is more corresponding to the within family predictions, whereas polygenic score, this genetic predictor for individual differences in the population, it captures both within family predictions, so it's able to predict like how siblings would be different from each other, but it, more generally, it predicts unrelated population, which includes the influence of their familial backgrounds, like familial advantages or disadvantages. So if we think of it like this way, then twin heritability correspond to within family predictions, whereas polygenic score heritability comprised of within and between family predictions. And we know that the missing heritability is how twin heritability exceeds the polygenic score heritability. But twin heritability actually only captures like a portion of the polygenic score predictions or polygenic score heritability. So that means polygenic score heritability kind of like cheated by including the familial background, whereas twin heritability doesn't and it still exists. So we think that's the reason why we think the missing heritability gap is larger than we were initially expecting, because I think
I was about to say it makes sense, because you're right, comparing twins to one another, that's a within family effect. And so the twin heritability reaches the ceiling because that's not taking advantage of those between family variables and the population level variables that these polygenic scores do. And so if twin heritability is something like 0.7 in a wealthy country, maybe if it did take advantage of those between family and population variables, maybe it'd be 0.85, 0.9.
Yeah.
And meanwhile, the
polygenic score has
scores. I wanted to say SNP, but we hadn't used that phrase yet in this.
We could start using
we're over half hour in. We can't introduce new terminology now. But the polygenic scores, they're taking advantage of those things. And so if we were comparing apples to apples, we would see a much larger gap of missing heritability. But for now, missing heritability looks smaller than it probably really is, because twin studies only have that within family relationship. That's very interesting. Probably one of the most interesting viewpoints I'd seen in the article. So I hope people read it for that to learn more about that.
Thank you. I think, sorry to interrupt, I think twin analysis also includes the between family effects, which is captured by the shared environmental components.
True.
Because we think about twin analysis, that's also like the reason why I think like twin design is one of like the most elegant, sophisticated design that I like in behavioral genetics, because it's so clean and neat that it captures this within family differences, and it also captures these like shared environmental influences where the siblings or twins share among their household as they're growing up. Mm-hmm. And then the rest of them, we can call it unique environment or like errors, because it's like all captures in the residuals, which is the unique factors that contributes to the differences among twins.
It is a very elegant, very informative design too. I mean, as cool as DNA-based polygenic scores are, there's a reason why the twin heritability study design has been around for 100 years, and it still gives us interesting information. You can't beat the classics sometimes.
Now,
what else should the public know about your article or about other behavioral genetics research?
I think two things I would say really like want to convey is that first, between family effects or the differences between the population predictions and within family predictions is not biased. So this is like the point that we mostly want to convey through our paper, because we could have called within family as direct genetic effects and between family as indirect genetic effects. But once we do that, everybody's like, I want to do something direct. I don't want to do these like indirect things. And also like direct and indirect are kind of like relative terms. So one thing is direct and the other is indirect. So we kind of like don't want to use this terminology, and we want to give a name to the like the difference, or like we said, like the inflation, the gap, the indirect is just, it needs a name. So it's just like cognitive and non-cognitive. One thing is yes, then the other is.
Yeah, there's this artificial division between cognitive and non-cognitive, and between so-called direct genetic effects and indirect effects. And so I see the value in calling it population level between family, within family.
And we could have just dismissed it, and then nobody will like study them. I mean, population stratifications, assortive mating, and passive gene environment correlation, these are very like real phenomenons and actually very interesting phenomenons. And if we just use within family predictions, then it will be like we don't allow people to find their partners based on their like preference, we just assign them with like random people. Then there's like random mating versus assortive mating. And then like population stratifications, we just randomly assign like people to like different geographical areas. And like passive RGE or passive gene environment correlation, that's worse, because that would be like, if we dismiss it, that would be like,
it's passive. It doesn't actively give us any information. Well, that's not true.
I mean, it's kind of like the terminology, the passive is more referring to like when the children don't actively involve in like this controlling. But yeah, if we dismiss passive RGE, then or passive gene environment correlation, then that would be like we take away the children from their parents, which are more likely to produce an environment that fits their genetic propensities, whereas we just like give these children to a random parents to provide a random environment to them. So these are very like real phenomenon, and we won't be able to capture them if we're mm-hmm. just looking at within family prediction. And I do agree that like for certain purposes, we may be interested in one effect or not. For example, if we're more interested in like how like the familial advantage and disadvantage or like socioeconomic status and how it functions, then we may look into one of it, or we may be more interested in like predicting differences between siblings than we look at within family effects. But overall, we think both of them are like valid predictions, and we don't mm-hmm. want to just cut one arm.
They have their predictive power, and we should, as scientists, be conscious of, oh, okay, some of this is within family genetic effect. Some of this predictive power comes from other places. But sum them all together, and we can predict a lot about people's lives based on their DNA. And you're right. I think that some of this terminology, indirect effects, oh, that's just population stratification, encourages us to dismiss these things, which can be informative as long as we keep them in mind that they have different roles in explaining a genetic environmental correlation. So that makes a lot of sense, and I like that.
Exactly. And I think like I have the luxury of starting my PhD with Professor Robert Plowman, who is my supervisor, a famous behavioral geneticist. And in like at the beginning of my PhD, he told me that, oh, these are not biased, and we should not just think of it as biased, then we just dismiss it. So I think I really have like the luxuries that he's helped me at the very beginning of my career. So I don't like, so I don't just develop my viewpoint, or like I just mm-hmm. Dismiss them because people think that they are not worth studying, or I guess it's not like not worth studying. I feel like I'm attacking people.
Well, just the idea that, oh, because it's not quote unquote direct, therefore it's less important. No, assortative mating between family relation variables like socioeconomic status, even population stratification, they matter to people's lives, sometimes more than the so-called direct effects do. And we shouldn't be dismissive of that.
Yeah, so especially when it comes to predictions, then they are like valid source of predict, so they contribute to this predictive power.
Exactly. If all you're interested in is predictions, you don't care if it's causal or not. The social media company showed us, so that's great. Well, thank you, Yujing. I appreciate you being on the podcast. I hope that our audience will check out the article. Again, it's in the journal Intelligence and Cognitive Abilities. We'll have a link to the article in the description of the video. The article's title is Polygenic Score Prediction Within and Between Sibling Pairs for Intelligence, Cognitive Abilities, and Educational Traits from Childhood to Early Adulthood. There's no paywall on this article. Anyone in the world can download it and read it anytime they want. If you're interested in this topic of the interplay between genes and environment and phenotypes, check out our previous episode with Michael Woodley of Mani, who also published an article in Intelligence and Cognitive Abilities about how the prison environment impacts phenotypes. Thanks for watching.